health differently. And as Wayne mentioned, I have a longstanding interest in urban-rural differences in end-of-life care. And one of the things that emerged from that was apparently a different set of values or goals in rural communities than in urban communities as people approach the end of life. And essentially approaching end-of-life decision-making in a more practical and personal, or as the people in Montana say, using the ethics of the familiar. And in the urban areas, you'd see much more concern about theoretical constructs such as the value of human life. And this stimulated an interest in mine as to whether or not we had broader differences in how we think about health in urban and rural communities. What I'll be presenting over the next 10 or 15 minutes is extremely preliminary. It's basically I'm reporting on our efforts to do a lit search and to learn what's out there. And this is all preparatory to research we're going to do in the future. And either at the end of my talk or more preferably right at the end of this session, if people have suggestions, methodologic or otherwise, for my team, I'd be very appreciative. Now, when I listen to talks here at APHA or anywhere, I often will develop in my mind a reservation about what the speaker is saying, and then I can't hear anything else. I mean, I'm repeating my reservation over and over again. So I'm going to do my study limitations right at the beginning rather than at the end. And the limitations include the fact that rural communities are very heterogeneous, very diverse, and so therefore any characterization of rural is right away flawed because which rural are you talking about? Another limitation would be that this literature contains very little rigorous comparison of rural and non-rural. There are lots of descriptions of rural, but often without an urban or non-rural comparison group. And then something that we were talking about earlier is a generational issue, and that's that the literature contains lots of descriptions of distinctive rural values, but they're often elders. And those elders may not be representative of the rural communities which are emerging with younger generations. Okay, nothing to disclose. Why we would be interested in this is because basically all theories of health behavior are rooted in the idea that you have to have an internalization of your concept of health first, and then you would move ahead and your health behaviors would be affected by what you believe is where your health comes from. If you don't believe you're sick, you're not going to do much about it. And so therefore, what we believe about health would affect not only health behaviors, but preventive and screening services, primary care, health education, particularly health education, because that's how we approach the messages that we use in working with our populations is going to be very much affected by what that population believes about health. Now, in collecting my material, I put together a lot of quotes, and it's perfectly good material for a one-hour talk, but unfortunately, we're going to be going through them more quickly, perhaps, than you can even read them, so I'll just be giving you highlights as we go. Our literature search, currently we have about 101 articles, and it's continuing, so suggestions really are welcome. And in my last slide will be my email address. And so if you say, oh, I know what they should look at, please do email me with suggestions. The four concepts that I'm going to be really dealing with are down at the bottom. Concepts of health, attitudes toward health, preserving health, and social and community context. These are, as I say, largely descriptive and therefore kind of an anthropologist's view, drilling down into what people believe, but not necessarily comparing it rigorously to any other population. So starting right away with concepts of health, we find a real emphasis on productivity and people being able to remain active. In other words, this is right from the outset an atheoretical and practical approach to health rather than thinking about, what might be identified as a health problem such as obesity or hypertension, which does not affect in an immediate and direct sense functionality. Ability to work was emphasized by many of the studies, and you can just see repetition, even the one that was concentrated only on heart failure down there at the bottom, was the interviewees repeated over and over again that the ability to work was what they were worried about, not longevity, not ability to climb stairs. ability to fulfill social functions parallels that for work, and so people that were able to be active in their community, attend their church, take care of their homes. Again, these are very atheoretical concepts, and we were looking for the theoretical constructs that would parallel them, and we could not find them. People were always invoking their ability to do things, rather than the ability to function, rather than the abstract concept of health. Of course, being able to do things is a way of preserving your autonomy and not being a burden to others. Again, something that was emphasized in a number of the studies. This is overall, if you sort of concentrate it all together, it represents a concrete and present-oriented way of thinking about health. Many people in this one study, 57 to 66% of participants reported being healthy despite the fact that the objective measures of their health were quite poor. And the other quote talks about why people might delay going to take care of something that is not an immediate problem. I think we'll move right ahead with this one again in the interests of time. In summary, for the concepts of health, the first of the four areas covering, that health is functional, it's not abstract, theoretical, or intangible, and it focuses largely on the present in these rural studies that we were examining. Now, the attitudes toward health, going deeper into that present orientation, that meant a lower interest in preventive services and actually less faith or confidence in the efficacy of preventive efforts. And this was like a red flag, because this was something that we were thought might be in the data, but we began to look into the studies that have been done and found a number of references to this kind of concept that people did not have much faith in or attach much importance to prevention. This wasn't due to education, although in my concluding remarks, I'd like to touch on that. Also, a strain of fatalism. Now, I don't know whether this is going to turn out to be purely generational once we get into it, but that there's very little you can do, and that you accept the status, your health status as it is, as a given. So fatalism was one thread, but the other one was one that would be more along the lines of stoicism, which I have here. Reading that large quote there, the people of Appalachia, the culture of Appalachia, is strongly influenced by individualism, traditionalism, family and community orientation, and fatalism. Persons may tend to consider their health status more or less stoically, and to be more willing to internalize the consequences of ill health. This would not be a description that would fit every family or every community or every individual, but it's something to, at least to be alert to when we're working with rural populations, whether or not there's a degree to which people are approaching their health as something that's a given, rather than as something that they can do something about. Now, I have a countervailing theme that I'll get to in just a second, so that this is interesting material to work on. Lower interest in comfort, pain, and cosmetic issues, and this was repeated in many of the studies. Interestingly, this first came out of the work of Weinert and Long in Montana, but it's been repeated in others. Two of the quotes there are from Weinert, but it was repeated in other studies that have been more recent, that basically not as much emphasis, or not very much emphasis, is going to be placed on comfort, pain issues, or cosmetic issues. I'll just go ahead here, again, in the interest of time. Now we go into the third arena, which is preserving health and what people believed they would need to do to preserve health. And here I actually got some surprises. Certainly there was a belief that you, if you will, that the health was not only a physical or biological or even mental issue, but it has a social and spiritual aspect to it. And there was almost an instinctive, if you will, a holistic approach to health. What we would celebrate in many of our discussions at APHA as a holism was coming rather in a sort of a genuine and untutored way to the people that were being interviewed in some of these rural studies. Social interaction was thought to forestall dependency, not as a marker of the fact that you were not dependent, but as something that would actually prevent dependency. This was the one that I thought was something of a surprise and beginning to get into an area that I was not familiar with personally in my own value system and my own experience, and that's that there was a degree of thread that came through many of the studies that attached a moral value to being healthy and a disinclination to respect people who allowed their health to deteriorate. In other words, there was a certain amount, not exactly of blame, but something close to blame or shame associated with ill health. I've actually got a better quote here in just a moment. This is more about spirituality. I'd like to, again, in the interest of time, I go through these fairly quickly. But here's the quote that I think is probably most telling. Those with and without diabetes said that the disease most likely developed from inactivity, which was termed laziness, and lack of self-discipline, eating too much sugar. Because of these beliefs, blame and guilt were often associated with the diabetes diagnosis, along with the perception that diabetes was self-inflicted. Now, as a person involved in health and public health, I do believe that diabetes is partially self-inflicted, but it was articulated better and more clearly in these interviews than a lot of us here at APHA would be a little bit embarrassed to say that diabetes is self-inflicted. We would think we were violating one of the codes of being concerned about our patients. That the people that were being interviewed in some of these rural communities weren't troubled by that. They were willing to go right ahead and say what they thought, which was that there's a degree, if not exactly of blame, at least of personal responsibility for ill health. I think these are what you'd expect that family and social support were integral to health. Now, in this last area, social and community context, this idea of illness as a moral weakness was the thing that really stood out for me. Again, it isn't every individual, it isn't every family, it isn't every community, but it was something that I had not seen in other literature, and I found it very, very interesting, and something that we'll want to pursue as we continue our work in trying to get into this. The rugged individualism, autonomous. I'd like to just spend a second on that because in my other research, in my other work, I've touched upon that a little bit in trying to understand rural suicide, particularly in elderly men in rural areas. There's a higher bump up in suicide rates. And if you stop and think about it, one of the things that's a moral value in many rural communities, particularly agrarian communities, which we've acknowledged are no longer the majority of rural communities, but is the sense that a good person takes good care of their land, their animals, and their equipment. It's really a moral value. I grew up in a rural area of southern Wisconsin, and farmers who did not take good care of their land and good care of their animals, good care of their equipment, were actually disparaged by their neighbors. They were felt to be morally deficient. It wasn't just that they were lazy, they were morally deficient. They weren't performing adequately. And what I think we see in elders in farming communities around the country is when they become, less able, less vigorous, less vital, and less able to take care of their own land and their own equipment and their own animals, they begin to become the people that they have despised all of their lives. And they see themselves in essentially entering into an unacceptable phase of their own life. And I'm personally convinced that that's behind at least some suicides in elderly men. And by the way, that the data seems to point exclusively to people that have been widowed, whose wives have died. But then they begin to become the people that they've held in contempt, and that may be contributing to it. What I'm emphasizing this one little piece for is to show the importance, if you will, of the value systems that people have internally and how they define what makes a good person or a healthy person. Stigma associated with mental health problems. This has been touched upon by many other speakers, and so I won't dwell upon it. And it's also, I think, familiar that access to mental health services is often one of the barriers. It's not just geographic, but the sense that your privacy may not be complete. People may recognize your car in front of the mental health clinic or whatever it is, and there's a number of barriers, if you will, to getting mental health services. I think I'll skip right to the end then, and many of these findings here were confirmatory of things that we would already know. So as we embark upon this area, we're still doing the literature search. We are going to be seeking federal funding for a grant to really look into this in more depth, with the principal goal being health education. The principal goal being, how can we craft messages that are going to be really effective and resonate with the values of the people we're trying to reach? And we're going to have to do a lot of work to craft a good study, because rural, non-rural comparisons are very light in the literature, and we would like to incorporate that. More importantly, many of these studies do not correct for SES. And if you don't correct for SES, you may actually be reflecting views that are reflective of education rather than reflective of rurality per se. In other words, if you are looking at, for example, an attitude toward cancer prevention, that may be more tightly tied to education than it is to where you live. So we have to be very careful with that, make sure we're not attributing things to rurality, which are in fact due to income, education, or some other aspect. Rural areas, as we all know, anybody that came to this session knows, rural areas are not defined very consistently. Wayne, you've published on that, I think. Anyway, we're familiar with the problems of the inconsistency of the definition of rural areas. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, we need to deal with the diversity of rural communities, separate out perhaps agrarian communities from others. Then lastly, boy, do we need to update this. If you were just noting my little notes on my slides, many of them are from the 90s. There are relatively few studies that have been in the last decade or so. So there's a real need to update the literature on this whole area of how people think about, define, and respond to health messages. So thank you very much. You will note my final conclusion here, the universal conclusion of all research, which is what keeps us in business.